But talking about who's in charge, free will and the science of the brain, with the guy who would know, the father of cognitive neuroscience. Can the brain be rebooted? Why would you ever want to do it? But if you could, can it happen? And what would be the result? What would there be some people who need to have their brains rebooted? We'll tell you about an interesting story from a couple of months ago coming up next. Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, we're talking about who's in charge, free will and the science of the brain. It's the latest from a lifetime of work dedicated to understanding the tension between the mind and the brain and where free will comes into that, or what we call free will anyway. Have you ever conducted experiments into the so-called rebooting of the brain?
No, but...
are you following it?
Well, but actually, no. Why don't you tell me the specific thing you're talking about?
Okay. Because, again, I throw that out there, not knowing how you as a scientist would describe it. We would use the term rebooting in general. I have a fairly debilitating case of tinnitus, which has been in discussion here lately on Coast to Coast. Basically, I'll be giving up my regular Saturday night slot so that I can focus more on the therapies. And as you know, probably, that tinnitus is a sound that the brain hears. It's not a sound that my ears hear, right? Some people liken it to phantom limb syndrome, where the brain detects, you know, an itching or something on an arm that's no longer there. And it's maddening to the person who has it because they can't ever scratch that itch. And in my case, the ringing of the ear is the ringing that I hear in my ears that's really just generated by my brain is from the dead cells that are in my ear. And the brain is sending a signal to them and it's interpreting it. It's almost like I've been told it's like a sonar, like a submarine that's sending out a pinging and it never gets a ping back. And so it's always just constantly sending that sound. And that's the sound I hear in my brain. Right. So somebody showed me an article last January about how they have stopped the ringing of tinnitus in rats by the so-called rebooting of the rat brain. And that this is something which, I mean, first of all, I don't know how they determined that they've given the rats tinnitus in the first place. Right. You'd have to explain that to me. I don't know. But they just got kind of a cross look on their face. Is that what it is? And you go, oh, those are the ones that have tinnitus. But that they rebooted their brains and therefore the brain no longer went searching for those dead nerves. The brain didn't know that those dead nerves weren't there, and so it no longer sent the noise which we hear as tinnitus. Does that sound like research that you're familiar? That was done by the NIH, I think, back in earlier part of this year.
I just don't know it.
But rebooting the brain. I mean, even that concept.
Yeah, I mean, one could imagine all kinds of neurologic injuries that would find the person having deficits, right? Everything from sensory deficits to various kinds of cognitive deficits. And if there was a way to take the person and to, if you knew enough about the inner workings and the information in the inner workings of the neurons that you could reprogram it or something like that. I mean, so that metaphor would be used. But what I think is more realistic way of thinking about it, if you want to reboot your brain, let's say I'm 72 years old. You're what, 30?
52, but thank you.
52. And you want to, and you don't remember exactly how to do algebra probably and quadratic equations and all that. But so when people say reboot, it's kind of the sense I get is that people want some instant way to bring all that back from their youth, right? Well, there's another way to reboot, and that's just go learn it again, right? Just go in and put in the hard work of becoming an expert on it again. Or there's another way, which is what is going on commonly now, in a sense that people have devices with them that do these things that they used to be able to do.
Right.
And then it falls to the device to serve that function for them. And that's externalizing another function to an artifact. But, you know, that's what everybody's doing, right?
Well, we
have our phones, we have our PDAs, we have our laptops,
right.
We have, you know, everything's going out to something else, and people are having completely different, I think, relationships and structures to how they retain knowledge because of those devices. And it's
right.
Like the old way where we just had to learn it by rote and over and over and over till we could remember it. Now we just say, oh, well, the phone numbers are over there, the addresses are over there, the math equations are over here. Who even does math anymore? You just push a button on a computer,
right?
Blah, 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 blah. So But that what you just described actually sounds very interesting, and I don't know what they actually did.
Well, I'll tell you. It says I have it up here from the NIH News. So they describe, here's how they described it. They were able to eliminate tinnitus in a group of rats by stimulating a nerve in the neck while simultaneously playing a variety of sound tones over an extended period of time. The hallmark of tinnitus is a persistent ringing in the ears that is annoying for some, debilitating for others. Me. And so they say this is similar to pressing a reset button in the brain. This new therapy was found to help retrain the part of the brain that interprets sound so that errant neurons reverted back to their original state and the ringing disappeared. It was conducted by scientists from the University of Texas at Dallas. And a private company called Micro Transponder Inc. I thought that was fascinating. I just didn't want to be the first guy that they strapped on this thing to.
Yeah.
The first, I respect the first person who says, "Do it to me first." But I thought
that all sounds. I mean, I get a little. It sounds plausible and kind of interesting. I just don't. I don't know if it's application yet for any kind of human.
Right, right.
Usually, how you it's like floaters in the eye and tinnitus. Everybody gets ringing in their ears, and how you usually cope with it is your attentional system just adjusts and tries to ignore it. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And you avoid the floaters in your eyes, and you work around them, and then, but if it's a strong, apparently you have a strong case of it, it's just annoying as hell. So
Hell would be the operative word. Thank you.
Well, fascinating. You taught me something. So.
Okay, well, see, but I think that's so interesting because this is, you know, it's pretty experimental, but that idea of being able to hit a reset button. So whether that's for tinnitus, maybe that's for physical things, and I was trying to think, what's the difference between that, say, and being given electroshock therapy? Some people say, and I know this will sound really awful, but some people have said that electroshock therapy done right really does make sense, and it was given a bad rap, and that there's still places where they do a form of electroshock therapy. And it has a fairly high efficacy rate.
That's all true.
What's that?
That's all true.
Yeah. Okay, well, talk about that. Because we think of that as being in a bygone era, and nobody, you know, put a piece of wood in their mouth, and, you know,
right.
But they're still doing it, and it really does work.
In serious cases of depression, it is still used, and it is not the Hollywood version of it where people are flipping around on the table. People are largely anesthetized and the voltage is passed through the brain. And what the underlying mechanism is that has this beneficial effect on depression. You know, I'm sure I'm not up on this right now. So but I'm sure there's stories about how the various neurotransmitters change in their activity, and there's a physiologic mechanism proposed for it, but clinically I know that it is used and it can be very successful.
Hmm. Well, and I think that you when you say that, then that is, it sounds like a kind of rebooting. If in the case of serious depression, what's actually being done? What is the electroshock doing to the brain that affects the mind?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, that's where it would seem like that's a really interesting connection again between what happens to the brain and what happens to the mind just by passing currents through it, electrical currents in it, and suddenly it reverses somebody's depression or makes their depression manageable or whatever. And again, it speaks to that idea of there's a certain part for some of us over which we just have we have very little control. I think of people who have had, you know, terrible experiences from their childhood, and they don't even know why they do some of the things they do. They're not conscious of it. They're not conscious that they're being mean, or they're not conscious of the fact that they can't stop themselves from having a sharp tongue. They just think this is who they are, and but it all comes back to maybe some way they were treated by their parents, and to this day, they still make the, but then someday later on, it comes out maybe in regression therapy from hypnosis or something. And suddenly you find out, oh, it was one thing from many years ago, and it just gets layered on, and you're not even aware of how all the ways that it shaped you.
Yeah. I would go with you only so far down that road of analysis. I mean,
tell me about that.
There are people who, in this whole free will determinism tension that we started with a lot about the book, what I was trying to do is say that even if we adopt this view that our behavior is determined because we are physical, chemical machines and follow the laws of physics and chemistry, et cetera, that doesn't speak to the fact that we are responsible for our actions. And so you say, well, what do you mean by that? He says, well, look, responsibility is something that we humans assign to the other person. So if you're going to be part of the human culture, I'm going to hold you responsible. That's a rule of social interaction.
Right.
And once you, so even though people can conclude that free will is not a concept of you, of use anymore because of our increasing understanding of the brain, that doesn't get them off the hook on accountability and responsibility, because that works at another level. That's the social level. That's the result of people interacting. And I think that's an important point, so that when you take your story here that someone says, well, they swear or they do this
because
they did something with their childhood, you say, yeah, okay, you had that happen in your childhood, but I can tell you 30 people had that same thing happen, and they don't swear.
Right.
So, by the way, one of the rules of culture is that that's not such a good idea to do.
Right.
And you are capable of learning rules, so learn it.
Right.
surrendering to some past condition and saying that's why I do everything, we all do that when we're lazy.
Right.
Thing about that, but you don't have to, just change.
Right. You know what? That's the parallel. When we brought up the legal example in our first hour of conversation, and I started to say something and then I said I'd get back to it. I was going to say the parallel to that is, are the people out there that believe that the devil makes people do things so that, that you have the reason why you've done something evil is because the devil whispered in your ear and you did it. And I always talk to those people and I always say, but then shouldn't that be the bulletproof argument in court to say it wasn't my fault? The devil made me do it. And they said, oh, but you had the free will to decide to do it or not. And that's what you're being held responsible for. But then that seems to sort of contradict it, because then if the devil whispered it and you did it, then the devil doesn't really, if we're just going to use that example, the devil doesn't really have any power. It's just another suggestion of 30 other suggestions of what can I do with my day today, and that we still are the ones who are consciously making that decision. And it's sort of a sticky wicket for people that argue that the devil makes people do bad things.
Do people really still say that?
Yeah. They do. And they really believe it up until that time the person goes to court. And that's suddenly when the whole argument seems to fall apart. And I'm not being cheeky when I say that. I always thought that was so interesting because even, you know, and I think that we can, there's some psychologists that believe in evil in that way, and that some people are born with, even with an evil brain. Do you believe in the possibility that somebody is just born with an evil brain?
Well, there are a couple books out on that right now as we speak.
Yeah.
By Cyan Baron Cohen, and another one is coming out on it I know about. And there are dispositions that people have that may be as a result of them not having the proper emotional responses to a normal human event, that they are emotionally flat and as a result that do inappropriate things with respect to everybody else, right? With respect to the social group they live in.
Sure.
And people, you know, so that you, psychopaths, for example.
Right.
Is neuroscience going to come along and really nail down what's wrong with the psychopath that explains their callousness with respect to hurting and harming other people?
Right.
And my guess is that it will. And the question then will be, what do we want to do about it? And see, that's why I think in my interest in this question, if we're really going to agree that we're going to hold people responsible for their actions, when we're dealing with criminal situations or antisocial situations, we should say, okay, look, Jones did it, right?
Right.
Now we as a culture and a society have to decide what we're going to do about it, okay? That's the tough question. So we got, let's take the horrible shooting of Congressman Gifford, right?
Right.
That person.
Right.
There's no question he did it. There's no question he's responsible for it. He intended to do it. He told his friends to, you know, forgive me for doing it. And he went and made change on the way to the shopping center. He knew all the rules of society, and then he still went ahead and did it. So he's going to be held responsible, but he's clearly mentally disturbed.
Right.
And now the judgment should be, I think we ought to say, responsible but insane.
Right. Not responsible by reason of insanity,
right.
Saying responsible, but also insane. Asterisk insane.
Right. So now what are we going to do with them? Right. Now that's a cultural decision. And what gets interesting real fast is down the road, you can see that maybe neuroscience and its development in the future will come up with treatments that could fix this guy. Right. Or fix the psychopaths that are highly likely to go back to the life and crime. So
right.
You can fix them, right? What does that do to the sense of justice on the part of the victim, the family, or what have you? Saying that you can fix that guy and put him back in the normal distribution versus wanting to punish him are feeling the necessity to punish them in some way seems to be a issue that cuts deeply into people's thinking about how we want to run our culture.
Sure.
So I think I don't think these are easy answers. Don't misunderstand me. I'm saying they're tough questions, but that's what we should be thinking about. Not whether he's responsible. Now we know that's the guy. Let's get on to this other question.
What's a better term than free will? If free will is problematic because of the way that it's been used in the past, I'll tell you what, you hang on to that. You don't have to, don't give me your first response. I'll come back. So hang on for a second. The thought of who's in charge, free will and the science of the brain. We're reconsidering the relationship between free will and those things which we do that may be determined by something else. even though we think of what our actions are as being free will. But the argument here is who's in charge. So I want to get to this very specific part of the book that I thought was fascinating. I mean, it's all good. Don't get me wrong. But there was one thing about our brain vis-a-vis our actions that I want to pull up coming up next. And maybe that's a way to talk about that, too. And then at some point, not yet, but in the last hour, we'll get to your calls, your questions, your comments on the way as well. And then also, if you missed it in the first hour, we're talking about the shift in consumer values and what that's going to mean for people in 2012. If you don't have it, you ought to get Coast Insider. You can listen to that anytime you want. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. So if we don't call it free will, what do we call it? Is there a better way of looking at it, a better term? And why you shouldn't have Dr. Michael Gazzaniga design your house. I'll just say it. Why, if you do anything right in your life, you never let him anywhere near a saw or a hammer around your house. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Bonnet. All right, so I went to a dog-eared section that I had in your book, "Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain," Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, and you were I really liked the part about chaos theory, and I was curious about that, but I was reminded of why when you're on, I make so many jokes. It's because you make so many jokes in your book. You have so many parenthetical little comments that you throw in, and they're very entertaining. But I especially like the story about how do you still live in the house that you built back in the 70s?
I'm sitting here right now.
Okay. Leaning to the left or to the right where you're sitting right now?
Well, it's finally been fixed.
Okay. But explain the problem of you building your own house back in, was it 1975 or something?
Yeah, it was. I designed it and I built it, and I was not skilled in these areas, but learned, was on the job training. So I got a few things wrong.
Mm-hmm. Measuring.
But it was, it's a long story. I have a defense.
You have a defense. That's fine. Is the defense level. Because you literally could roll roll a ball from the living room into the kitchen.
Well, yes, that's true. There's a 20-foot drop from the back wall to the front, and you could roll a ball down it once upon a time. As I said, the intervening years found us repair it, and it's fun. It's a lovely place, and we're happy to be here.
Okay. Love that. But that even the counters weren't level, and if you're looking at some of the window jams, the sills weren't level.
Well, no. See, because the floor wasn't level when we when we propped up the walls, right, which were framed all, they were all level, but because they had to sit on the slab, they tilted a little bit.
Okay,
and so we could see. On because the ocean was the horizon of the ocean was behind us, we could detect the tilt that I had put in the slab, and so it required some footwork to get it all fixed, but we did it.
Okay, so what do you learn from that?
Well, in the book, we're trying to get into the fact that there's precise measurement and imprecise measurement, and I was
right.
I'm telling a joke on myself.
Right. But it's an interesting way of getting into precise measurement and imprecise measurement as it pertains, and then eventually into chaos theory, too.
So, well, we're kind of jumping in the middle here. But
I know.
So if everybody was happy when Newton came along and developed his laws, and determinism was felt to be the last word, and the world had finally been straightened out, and everybody was happy. And then in the early 20s, of course, quantum mechanics came along and was discovered that Newton's laws didn't quite apply to quantum mechanic effects. And that because of that, there was thought to be wiggle room, that there you couldn't measure in place and time at the same instant. And so you had this situation of uncertainty. And in that uncertainty of measurement, people said, aha, that's the wiggle room that would allow us to believe in free will. The problem with the, and so quantum mechanics is obviously true, and Newtonian mechanics is obviously true. And so the question is, can a quantum system build something that follows deterministic rules? And the answer is yes, it builds. There's all kinds of atom interactions and billiard balls, but once they're billiard balls, they follow Newtonian rules, which are very deterministic. So people were excited for a while that physics and quantum physics was going to be the out for this deterministic juggernaut that was developing in the human knowledge. But it turns out it was just not the right level to look at the problem.
Yeah.
So people pretty much abandoned it as an explanation. And so now we take that all the way up that people think that the nervous system works in sort of Newtonian rules, following Newtonian laws, and therefore it's deterministic and mechanistic, and therefore things are determined. So that's kind of...
But it's an interesting point, because even the universe itself, if that's the model, which is not, we think we can account for everything, but we can't. And that there's still knowledge to be gained. And in the same way, the same thing is true for the body, that it isn't just a matter of just neurons firing in some predictable way.
So if you have a determined system, it doesn't mean that the actions will result in an inevitable outcome.
Right.
Because there are too many intervening variables that you can't possibly take into account. And so this is another tripwire in this whole storyline, that being happy and accepting the fact that it's a deterministic system that allows our brain to be our mind and so forth and so on, that does not mean that everything is known and can be predicted because of all these intervening things that can happen by chance, right? And so that's an important framework to remember, that quantum mechanics can build things that follow Newtonian principles. Newtonian principles can build things that don't necessarily produce an inevitable outcome because there's too many other interactions that can't be part of the determined model. Too complicated.
Got it. So then
that's the idea.
So if will is entirely free, though, I mean, we have some aspects of it that are, but if will isn't entirely free and we live in some sort of tension, what's a better word? What's a better term? What's a better way of describing that? I thought you hit on a couple of different variations of that in the book.
Well, so here's the way that I think that helps people think about it. So I turn around and ask the question, what do you want to be free from, right? So this concept that's deposited in our minds, this free will thing,
right?
So that there's we're not coerced by outside forces, that you're responsible for your actions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So now you say, okay, you know, that was a nice idea when we didn't know anything, but we know a lot now. I mean, if a Martian came down to Earth now, and
right,
looked at the human species and then began to see how it worked, right?
Right.
We generate the idea of, well, and the other thing that we need to stick in this thing is free will. What do you mean? That's not how it works.
Well, okay, except that
it works this other way. And so then you say, okay, all right, well, then now what do you want to be free from?
But you keep using that preposition. What about free to? Not free from. So I'm free to do things. I'm not trying. Free will for me is not, I am breaking something which has been, predetermined for me. I think of free will as the will to do something, which is even on an impulse, maybe even something I'll regret, but I'm free to do it, in that there isn't anything that's making me say, when I'm standing in front of the buffet, to say, you know what, today I'm going cake. And that by saying today I'm going cake is just a pure act of free will, not free from anything that's saying I can't have cake. I'm just saying today that's me at this moment.
And I'm saying that your decision to have cake is a decision you've made from past experience, from the payoffs of past experiences, from your internal disposition, from your hunger state. And just as you so nicely said at the beginning of the show, all that goes into this decision system that allows you to finally act. So if you talk about what is it that makes this thing turn into an action is what we're trying to understand. And we now understand it works in this particular way X, right? I mean, that's what the book about. By the way, I'd like to just make a comment, if I could, that everybody has an opinion on free will. Everybody, I promise you.
Right.
And so the particular view that I'm arguing for and suggesting here is the result of a lifelong journey trying to understand the brain and my contribution to it, right? Now, to get the feel for the position I'm trying to hammer out here, you kind of.
I'm careful. When you got a hammer, I'm worried. If you got a hammer, I don't. I know too much now.
You got to know something about it. You know, what am I saying about it?
Okay.
You got to know you got to see how it works and what we know about it. And so,
right.
So that's why just jumping in on the vote at the end of the ball game here is hard. You know, it's just saying, well, it's another guy with an opinion on free will. Yeah, but it comes out of this journey of seeing how this big piece of tissue works.
Well, I think it's all good. I think you're unnecessarily self-conscious about that, because I think people are they're on board. They understand that because a lot of people, I mean, many people's view of free will is shaped entirely by a religious experience, not a scientific one.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right? The understanding of free will is just, you know, you have sort of a Calvinist viewpoint that says all of our actions were predetermined and that we merely, you know, we're living out those predetermined actions. Our salvation is predetermined. We think we can do something to affect it, but we can't. And that there's a ledger of sorts somewhere that writes down that already has the answers in it. And we'll never in our lifetimes, we'll never know whether or not we're in the good ledger or the bad ledger. Right. That's how some people think of.
Yeah, some people think about that. The whole thing that way. I don't.
I understand it. As the old joke goes, you know, two Presbyterians are walking down the sidewalk. One of them trips and breaks their arm, and the one says to the other one, "Aren't you glad that's over?"
That's great.
Yeah, but that's full type of that kind of double predestination thinking, right? That's the So I'm saying that's actually where most people get their view of what free will is. It's entirely a religious paradigm, not a scientific one at all.
Right, but you see that's why William James, the great American psychologist, just thought that was to think of determinism in that simplistic way is crazy, because there's too many chance events intervening, and there's no informational system in the world that can possibly take that into account. And so, again, a determined system doesn't mean predictable. Inevitable is, I guess, a better word. Inevitable.
Better way to look at it.
Yeah.
But I think that's why, but just to go back to what you're saying before, I think that's why actually most people, I think for you to be talking about free will as being sort of in the tension between the mind and the brain and all these other, there's all of these different events, but that you still have to be held responsible for it. It doesn't free you up from the end result of being responsible for it. But then we talked about how some people are less responsible than others in one sense. We hold them legally responsible, but we know their mental condition was such that they may not even have been aware of what they were doing, because they were living in such a fantasy world that to them, they might as well have been an avatar in a video game in their mental state. And we think of those people as different. But in every other respect, you know, we are responsible for the things we do, even if we have been highly influenced along the way to do them.
I think that There's an interesting subtle point here that one could easily say, it seems to me, that anybody that commits a horrible act against another human is not acting responsibly, and they're free from all these easy outs, okay? They're not brain damaged. They're not this or not that. They're socially, culturally got to be in their bonnet about something, and they do something horrible. You know, and we would say, well, they're not acting responsibly. And so what are we talking about here? And I kind of think that when we talk about responsibility, it is a ticket to be with a social group. It's a value that we apply to the other person. We're going to hold you responsible if you're part of this social group. That's just how this thing works. And
right.
And so responsibility is, that's why I keep saying it's in the social, at the social level of interaction. That's where you've got to understand the problem. And then when we get that cleared, then, as I say, we go back and consider the tough questions. What do we do with the person who commits something against the society?
Right. And so when people are on the jury.
Yeah.
Just to go back to a legal paradigm again for deciding somebody's guilt or innocence, to what degree are they making independent decisions about somebody's guilt or innocence? And how much are they just simply working out of the same pre-programmed box that the person who committed the alleged crime did?
Well, they're all decision makers, and they're listening to the information presented in the court, and their lifelong history of how you make a decision given social information or any information is all active. And then as a group, they're talking to each other, and the social, I mean, you know, I don't think much is being given away with this view. This is just how we work. And
right.
for people to come along and for a science to come along and say, you know, we're understanding actually how this thing actually works. How does, you know, no one has a problem when we talk about, we now know how the kidney works. We now know how the heart works, right? We now know how this works, that works. But when you say the brain, we now know how that works in this automatic ways. That's where people get touchy, right?
Right.
They feel you're interfering with the humanness of and the beauty of the human experience that you and I have.
Makes us different than other animals? What makes us different than lower forms of life?
Well, some
people would say.
Yeah, right. And there's a million things, and so, but so I, it's just. That's why I think it's fun to read the story why people hold a view like I hold a view.
Right.
Because you just see the thing working and how it works, and you just kind of marvel at it. You know?
Right. It's an entertaining read, and I really love, I mean, I still have my copy of The Ethical Brain. I thought you really hit something there that people hadn't, I had never heard articulated in a particular way. But then again, that's why you are the father of cognitive neuroscience as well as the father of experimental carpentry, apparently.
Good for you.
All right. So if we're going to abandon the concept of free will, I go back to something you said. I underlined it. Puncturing the illusionary bubble of a single willing self is difficult to say the least. The single willing self. That's again why I come back to is the way to describe it, even if is the word free and will, do those come as such loaded words that you say them in front of, you know, 10 people and you're going to have 10 different ways of how they're looking at the words free and will. And whether there might be, it's time to have another way to describe that. That isn't burdened by, say, you know, 400 years of theological dispute about what that means in an entirely different way. If you're using it in a purely scientific way, that's all. I don't know whether that, I don't have an answer for you on that, but I think that might be eventually what we're going to have to come down to is another way of describing that action or describing it, even though we're reterming it, even though you're redefining it in a way. All right. So, did you want to say something real quick?
I was going to say that someone put it to me the other day, we have will, but it's not free.
Right. So that.
So that means, but what we're trying to understand is really action, right?
Okay.
So, how do we choose to do X versus Y? That's what we're doing all the time, a gazillion times a day. And we have a special system in the brain that makes us think that that special us in there is doing it. So, well, as I said at the beginning, that never goes anywhere. That stays with all of us. And we understand that mechanism, how it works. Anyway.
And you'll stay with us one more hour, and we'll get the phones are already ringing for Dr. Michael Gazzaniga on Coast to Coast.